I next met with another ONS Symposium faculty member, Dr. Melissa Johnson, also from Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville, who was part of our symposium on lung cancer. To begin, Dr. Johnson commented on evolving research in identifying genetic mutations in these tumors that in many cases can be successfully treated with targeted therapy.
Finding mutations in patients' tumors is increasingly important in how we take care of patients with lung cancer. We know that roughly between one-third and one-half now of patients will have some oncogenic driver in their cancer, and the most common being EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. At Sarah Cannon, we look for those three mutations in every patient with a newly diagnosed non-squamous lung cancer.
I guess we should point out that not every EGFR mutation is sort of an activating mutation. There are potentially three EGFR TKIs that are used, erlotinib, a common one, but also afatinib as well as gefitinib. What do we know about those three, and what do people tend to utilize first?
So here in the United States, I think we are most comfortable with erlotinib. It's been around the longest here in the United States. In Asia and Europe, gefitinib has also been around for a similar amount of time. Afatinib was the most recent first-generation EGFR inhibitor to join the group. I think in the United States, oncologists have a preference for erlotinib or afatinib as a result. And it sort of depends on practice patterns and whether or not an oncologist has a level of comfort using one or the other. The nice thing about erlotinib is that the side effect profile is very manageable. Rash and diarrhea are commonly seen, but the dose of erlotinib can be modulated depending on the side effects, and we know that that doesn't compromise the efficacy of the drug. I think that's also true for afatinib, honestly, and I've used both of those drugs in my patients. There are a couple different trials that compared afatinib to chemotherapy for patients with EGFR mutations, and in retrospect, the patients with exon 19 deletions seemed to do better with afatinib. And so there is some suggestion that these exon 19 deletion mutations respond really nicely to afatinib. However, subsequently, there's also been other trials to suggest that actually there may not be so much of a preference after all. And so again, I think it comes back to the preference of the oncologist.
What about tolerability profiles in general? What do you see with this class of drugs? And can you kind of distinguish between the three?
So the main side effects of all three of these drugs are rash and diarrhea, of course. We see it with all three drugs. I tend to see a higher rate of toxicity and more severe toxicity with afatinib as opposed to erlotinib. And gefitinib, because it is a drug that didn't go all the way up to maximally tolerated dose in its clinical trials, tends to be the best tolerated of the three. I will say that afatinib, like erlotinib, can be dose reduced. So if you start at a dose of 40, which is the maximally tolerated dose of afatinib, and you find that the rash is severe, I counsel my patients in that case to stop the drug for 5 days. There are a number of creams that we can use to help with rash. Of course, Imodium and Lamotil helps with the diarrhea. And then you can restart afatinib at 30 milligrams. In fact, I actually start at 30 and work my way up for patients that tend to tolerate it better. The same is true for erlotinib. I tend to start at 100. The maximally tolerated dose is 150. You can go up if you have a patient that tolerates it really well, but you can also be comfortable just keeping a patient at 100.
So one of the things about targeted therapy is, although it often will lead the patient to have a response, I guess it's more likely a year or year and a half, what we do see too is that these responses don't last forever and the patients then develop progressive disease. And one of the things that's kind of different about the EGFR tumor mutations is there's an assay that can be done on the patient who's relapsing now on first-line TKI, the T790M mutation. Can you talk about what that is and how that is sort of integrated into what happens to the patient?
Sure. It's true, Neil. Targeted therapies are a wonderful invention, but the truth is that all patients will eventually develop what we call acquired resistance to treatment. And that is, I explained to my patients that this is as the tumor begins to figure out how to grow despite the inhibitor. So when the tumor starts to get smart. We divide acquired resistance to erlotinib or afatinib or gefitinib up into two groups. The most common cause of acquired resistance is a secondary mutation in EGFR called T790M. And this is basically I think it's interesting that this is a substitution of a bulky methionine group for the threonine amino acid. So it basically blocks the erlotinib or the whatever the TKI is from binding. So it is pretty smart on the part of the cancer. In any case, only about half of patients who develop resistance will be due to T790M. The others are a myriad of other mechanisms that we're still learning how to target. So it can be small cell transformation. It can be expression of MET amplification, HER2 amplification, and AXL overexpression and others. For patients who are found to have a T790M secondary mutation, they can be treated with another FDA-approved drug, osimertinib. Osimertinib is probably the best example of how once we understood the molecular mechanism that was underlying the development of resistance, we were able to develop a drug that was smart and really well tolerated. This is, I think, one of the best tolerated drugs in the oncologist's toolbox right now.
I guess the one thing about osimertinib that seems interesting is, you know, we were talking about side effects, particularly GI side effects and skin side effects that are seen with these agents like erlotinib, afatinib. And I guess they're thought to be because of the inhibitor working against EGFR in normal tissues.
Wild type, right.
Not the tumor that has the mutation in it. Whereas it seems like osimertinib is more specific to the tumor and not to the wild type normal tissues.
Osimertinib is a T790M specific inhibitor. That's right. So it's going to target the secondary T790M mutation as well as the mutated EGFR, and it spares the wild type EGFR. And that, as you say, it's inhibiting the wild type EGFR that leads to the rash, that leads to the GI side effects. I think this is an example of the information we had learned from years of research with erlotinib, gefitinib, and afatinib that the drug developers employed when developing this new drug.
So again, in the second line situation, you have a patient who's had a response first line, then you test them. If they're T790 positive, they go on osimertinib, but again, no checkpoint inhibitor?
Yes, I still think the jury's out about whether these patients benefit from a checkpoint inhibitor. There certainly isn't any data to use those drugs together. So right now, I'd be very comfortable using osimertinib alone and saving the checkpoint inhibitor.
Now, we know that most patients in that situation are going to have another response. Most of these patients are going to do very well without toxicity. What about the other patients, I guess about half of them, who don't have the T790M mutation? How are they treated?
Well, right now, that's a big area of investigation. I think many patients that don't have access to clinical trials are receiving chemotherapy if they're found not to have T790. So patients can be treated with carboplatin and pemetrexed. There are a number of trials that are combining other drugs with erlotinib in that setting. So erlotinib plus a MET inhibitor, erlotinib plus an AXL inhibitor, trying to stop those mechanisms of resistance, again, that have been found in tumor specimens. I think another trick that I used in practice before moving to Sarah Cannon was adding bevacizumab, because we know that there's good phase 2 data that erlotinib and bevacizumab together potentiates the activity of erlotinib alone. But the shorter answer to your question is that there is no standard for those patients, and so we're still looking for the best way to treat them.
So let's move on and talk about some other tumor genomic alterations and how people are treated. And Molly Reed, who you work with, presented a patient, a young patient, 29 years old, with ALK rearranged metastatic disease, presented really very, very sick in the ICU. Ended up, they found out he had a ALK translocation, got crizotinib, had a really good response, and has been on a bunch of other therapies since that time. First of all, can you talk a little bit about your vision of sort of what ALK rearranged lung cancer actually is?
Sure. So it's a little different than the mutation in EGFR that we were talking about. It's a translocation. So it's two parts of a chromosome that get snarled up on each other as cells are dividing and result in a transfer of genetic information from one arm to another of the chromosome, leading to, again, that on switch that begins to upregulate the cancer's growth. And so in the same way as erlotinib or gefitinib or afatinib turns off the light switch that is the EGFR mutation, crizotinib, ceritinib, now brigatinib, and alectinib all turn off the light switch that is that transfer or that translocation of genetic information in an ALK-positive cancer. The result is the same. You get a tremendous response rate in the 60 to 80% range. Patients are very symptomatic and then not at all. There are a few differences between patients with EGFR mutations and ALK rearrangements that I think are interesting. They tend to be younger. They tend not to do as well with chemotherapy, which is in distinction to patients with EGFR mutations that tend to do really well with chemotherapy as well. And the mutation seems to be even more important. As I see patients in the drug development unit in phase one who have progressed on all of these standard regimens, they are still addicted to ALK, where it's the EGFR positive patients I find that tend to have developed other mutations that maybe make them a little bit more susceptible to immunotherapy in the refractory space, for example.
So we now amazingly have four approved ALK inhibitors. Can you talk about each one of them and sort of how they're used clinically?
Sure. So, of course, the oldie but the goodie is crizotinib. It was the first ALK inhibitor that was approved for the treatment of patients with ALK rearranged lung cancer. It has a frontline indication. Side effects tend to be GI, some visual side effects, sometimes edema, swelling. Ceritinib was the second ALK inhibitor to be approved. It was approved for patients who had developed resistance to crizotinib. Ceritinib is a more potent ALK inhibitor. It tends to have activity in the CNS, which is important for this subset of lung cancer patients who have refractory disease in the CNS quite frequently. The side effects associated with ceritinib are more potent. The GI toxicity, the fatigue, tends to be more potent than crizotinib, and patients tend to need a dose reduction with ceritinib as opposed to crizotinib in my experience, which I've been able to give at the maximally tolerated dose without a problem. The two newer kids on the block are brigatinib, FDA approved, I believe, in April of this year. It's an interesting ALK inhibitor with an interesting addition to the side effect profile. In a small percentage of patients, there is an interstitial lung disease that can develop. It seems to happen early on in treatment. And so for this reason, patients are treated with 90 milligrams of brigatinib, and then the dose is escalated after a week of therapy to 180. Brigatinib has a much more exquisite CNS penetration, and it is, for the vast majority of patients, very well tolerated. And then finally, alectinib has been approved for several months in the refractory space. It is, again, a very well-tolerated ALK inhibitor, maybe better than crizotinib, and it, once again, has really good CNS penetration. We heard at ASCO the results of the ALEX trial comparing frontline use of alectinib to crizotinib, and patients with alectinib had a significant improvement in their progression-free survival. So we believe that alectinib will gain a frontline indication and will change the standard of care in how we take care of patients with ALK-driven lung cancer.
So we're talking about the algorithm in metastatic disease in terms of sequencing of agents with EGFR and how the T790 comes in. What about with ALK disease after you give a first-line TKI, crizotinib, or maybe alectinib, then what?
So this is another area where the drugs and the lung cancers are a little different. So what we're learning is each of the different ALK inhibitors will result or is likely to result in different resistance mutations. And so increasingly, we are biopsying patients at the time of progression, either with a tissue biopsy or in the blood, looking for these resistance mutations that then can determine the next best ALK inhibitor to give. This is a little academic still, and I treat patients in the community. We don't always have access to this testing. And so it is, once again, many oncologists, just their practice preferences or how they're choosing ALK inhibitors. There is a large intergroup trial trying to look at sequence. And so I think there will be more information about this in coming years.
So we know that while these are the two sort of tumor alterations that get the most attention, there's been a lot of research. There are others that are sort of coming along. And again, Molly presented a patient that you actually take care of who had a BRAF mutation. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and how people are being approached to have this tumor mutation, including your patient?
Sure. So BRAF mutations, specifically the BRAF V600E mutation, is found in somewhere between 2 and 3% of lung cancer patients. And we're taking a lesson from the books of melanoma doctors in how to take care of patients with these mutations, because, of course, BRAF V600E mutations are very common in metastatic melanoma, 30%. So we're treating patients with BRAF inhibitors such as vemurafenib or dabrafenib with or without MEK inhibitors like trametinib. Again, learning from the experience of the melanoma doctors who've been doing this for a while. This patient actually is being treated on a clinical trial with a BRAF inhibitor and a MEK inhibitor and has tolerated it really well with minimal rash, which is a common side effect, minimal fevers, which is another side effect from the MEK inhibitor in particular, and just impressive rebounding in her performance status that started within a week of starting these drugs.
So she had actually an objective response to this treatment?
She has and continues to have slow but continued shrinkage with subsequent scans. This, I'll remind you, she was enrolled in this trial after she was treated with an immunotherapy. Now, for patients that don't have the typical mutations, we tend to try immunotherapy second line because many, many, many patients are being treated with immunotherapies. For her, her clinical picture was challenging, but she was progressing on immunotherapy. We were worried about pneumonitis, but she was not responding as we had hoped that she would. And so this makes the response that she had to the BRAF-MEK combination that much sweeter.
And, you know, it kind of looks like BRAF is particularly being treated with this combination, kind of is starting to follow sort of the path of EGFR and ALK. And it seems like most people do respond. And we're hearing people talking about even using this first line before chemo.
Yep. There was a trial that included a subgroup of patients treated in the front line. And I don't believe that we've heard the final results of that trial to know whether patients' outcomes are better with the molecular inhibitors in this case, in contrast to chemotherapy. But I think this is something that we are increasingly doing, finding a mutation, finding a targeted inhibitor and applying it, and moving that therapy up in lines of therapy from not the third or the fourth line of therapy, but the second and maybe the first line of therapy.
So I want to move on now and talk about, I guess, the more common situation where you don't see a genomic alteration in the tumor. You could call it wild-type disease. And we had a patient who was presented by Pam Goodwin, actually, a patient who had metastatic squamous cell cancer. And this patient actually, because of the fact, I guess, she had a TPS score, PD-L1 TPS score that was over 50%, got the checkpoint inhibitor pembrolizumab, actually seems like responded to the treatment, but also developed some problematic diarrhea that they were concerned might be related to the checkpoint inhibitor. First of all, maybe you can talk a little bit about the approach to a patient. As you mentioned before, in metastatic squamous cell or squamous cell, we don't really see many, if any, of these tumor alterations. How you think through the patient who's first presenting with metastatic squamous cell cancer?
Well, I think the standard of care changed in October 2016 when we learned that patients with PD-L1 high tumors had improved response with pembrolizumab compared to chemotherapy. And that was a trial that enrolled patients that were squamous and non-squamous. In the absence of other oncogenic drivers, there's a lot more interest in finding good options for patients with squamous cancer. So, of course, PD-L1 testing is the first thing that I think about. For patients who are PD-L1 high, the answer is clear. I would use pembrolizumab. For patients who are PD-L1 intermediate or low, those patients are treated right now with chemotherapy. Carboplatin-based regimens, either with nab-paclitaxel or with gemcitabine, tend to be my platinum doublets of preference.
Could you talk a little bit about the various choices for chemotherapy that are commonly thought about in squamous cell that people consider, and why it is that you, as you mentioned, generally you like to go with carboplatin with either nab-paclitaxel or gemcitabine?
So for my approach to a metastatic squamous lung cancer at presentation, of course, includes PD-L1 testing. For patients that are PD-L1 intermediate or low that are not eligible to receive pembrolizumab, I begin to think of platinum doublet chemotherapy options. The first decision point is cisplatin or carboplatin. And the second question is what the partner is going to be, gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel. And then for patients who receive platinum gemcitabine, do you want to add nesetumumab, I suppose, to the regimen? For patients with metastatic disease, I tend to use carboplatin, not cisplatin. And I find that nab-paclitaxel is well tolerated with carboplatin for these patients and perhaps has a little bit less in the way of count suppression as compared to the carboplatin and gemcitabine.
I have heard people talking about using nab-paclitaxel as opposed to paclitaxel more in people with squamous cell, such as this situation, and also in older patients. Is that your practice?
Based on the Sosinski data, the response rate was highest in the squamous subset for patients treated with platinum plus nab-paclitaxel. That was a subset analysis, and I don't know that I've seen a higher response rate from this platinum doublet in my own practice, but I do agree with the tolerability, and I think that's why the elderly analysis was interesting. I think when you have patients coming in weekly for therapy, getting a lower dose, you can monitor their side effects, you can address symptoms before they get out of control. I find that week by week, it's easier to manage patients with performance status, lesser performance status in general.
And you mentioned also nesetumumab. Can you explain what that is, what we know about it, and to what extent, if any, you utilize this agent?
So nesetumumab is a monoclonal antibody directed against EGFR. It was used in a frontline study with cisplatin and gemcitabine. Patients were randomized to cisplatin, gemcitabine with or without nesetumumab. And the addition of nesetumumab improved survival on the order of a month in terms of progression-free survival and a week, I think, in terms of overall survival. Nesetumumab is similar to cetuximab, of course, another monoclonal antibody directed against EGFR, where there was some interesting data with other platinum doublets in the past. And so there is some subset of patients that benefit from nesetumumab. Its side effects include rash, as we've talked about already today, consistent with EGFR inhibitors. And it is quite a severe rash in contrast to osimertinib and erlotinib and afatinib that we've discussed. And so the risk-benefit analysis for me is not on the side of using it routinely in my practice.
So in terms of checkpoint inhibitors, and you mentioned pembrolizumab, there are other checkpoint inhibitors that are used in the second line approved in lung cancer. Can you go through the other checkpoint inhibitors and how they're utilized?
Sure. So pembrolizumab was initially approved in the second-line setting for patients who were platinum refractory and had PD-L1 high tumors, so 50% or greater. And then about the time that the frontline data was reported that showed a benefit to pembrolizumab versus frontline chemotherapy, that label was expanded so that patients with any amount of PD-L1 expression can be treated with pembrolizumab in the second line setting. By contrast, there is another PD-1 inhibitor, nivolumab, and a PD-L1 inhibitor, atezolizumab, that are approved in the second line setting for all comers, irrespective of the PD-L1 expression in their tumor. And so before pembrolizumab was approved in the front line, nivolumab and atezolizumab were appealing because doctors didn't have to check the PD-L1 expression on the tumor in order to use it.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the issue of tolerability and side effects with checkpoint inhibitors. We know this is a completely new paradigm for the oncology office because now for the first time we're talking about autoimmune toxicity, where with chemotherapy it was a very different scenario. This patient had this issue of diarrhea. They weren't sure whether it was related. What happens in terms of the generation of these side effects, and what are the more common ones and the ones that are concerning?
Sure. So I think the first thing that we all heard about these immunotherapy drugs is how well tolerated they were. And certainly they are as compared to chemotherapies like docetaxel. But the reality is that these drugs work by boosting the patient's immune system to recognize the tumor. But they also result in the immune system recognizing other organs in the body, like the skin, and that causes dermatitis, like the intestines or the colon, and that causes colitis or diarrhea, like the thyroid gland, other endocrine glands, and that causes hyper and hypothyroidism. I would say those three side effects are the most common side effects that we see: dermatitis, colitis, diarrhea, colitis when it's severe, and endocrine abnormalities, especially hypothyroidism.
Can you talk about, from a clinical point of view, how your clinical operation sort of manages patients who've had one checkpoint inhibitors who call in and say they're having diarrhea?
Sure. So I think my practice has a significant experience with this at this point. It does make yellow flags go off for all of us. I think certainly the first step is to make sure that patients are maximally using anti-diarrheal medicines like Imodium and Lamotil, because that can stop the problem. However, steroids are the next step or the next level of side effect management, and 1 mg/kg oral steroids is typically what we will prescribe, with, of course, stopping or delaying the drug. And if that does not get rid of the diarrhea quickly, then patients need a colonoscopy, and they may need IV steroids because the oral steroids may not be being absorbed effectively. So that's sort of the tiers that we've taught the nurses to think through in how to triage when patients call with diarrhea.
And what about the unusual situation where you really have a full-blown colitis? How do you manage those patients?
Yeah, so those patients should be admitted. Those patients need a colonoscopy. 2 mg/kg of prednisone and solumedrol twice a day is typically the steroids that we use. And if that's not enough, then infliximab is typically what we add in addition. Some more potent immunosuppressive agents can really be the difference. I've also used mycophenolate mofetil, which is another immunosuppressive agent we use for transplant with some success.
So another not uncommon problem with checkpoint inhibitors that seems to be a particular issue in lung cancer is pneumonitis. Can you talk a little bit about sort of how those patients present, how you figure out whether it's the drug or the disease or their underlying chronic lung disease, and how you manage these patients?
It's challenging. Lung cancer patients have symptoms from their cancer, obviously, and usually because they smoked as well. And so they have an ongoing level of symptomatology that's just related to their comorbidities. Pneumonitis tends not to be subtle. It tends to be an abrupt change in how they're able to breathe. I've had patients with pneumonitis who presented not with cough or shortness of breath, but actually with fevers. And so that's always in the back of my mind when I'm seeing a patient who's complaining of more shortness of breath, more cough, and fevers. A CT scan is usually my first stop. A chest x-ray is good for screening and surveillance maybe, but the anatomy is so much better with a CT that I'll send patients for it the same day if need be. And the findings on a CT scan indicate pneumonitis are not subtle either. I use my pulmonologists quite a lot to distinguish between a pneumonitis and maybe a rapid progressive disease. You'll get cancer cells back if it's progression, and you'll get lymphocytes back and no cancer cells if it's a pneumonitis. You also know then that it's not an infectious pneumonitis or an infectious pneumonia. And that's important when you're considering walloping the patient with large doses of steroids. So if the bronchoscopy and the cell count come back showing high level of lymphocytes, I feel confident to start the patient, usually admit the patient, start the patient on oral or IV steroids, 1 to 2 milligrams per kilogram a day.
So let's finish out talking about the non-squamous cancers that don't have any genomic alterations. We were talking about EGFR, et cetera. And there we have a different option that, as you mentioned, actually in Denver in the beginning of May, we didn't know that a couple weeks later, the FDA was actually going to approve, as you said, the combination of pembrolizumab with chemotherapy, carboplatin and pemetrexed, probably the most common type of chemotherapy used in non-squamous. Can you talk a little bit about the options up front, and particularly that option, and whether there are situations where you might want to actually use both a checkpoint inhibitor and chemo together?
Sure. So the study that led to the FDA approval of this carbo-pem-pem or CPP combination, I've heard people say, was a small randomized phase 2 trial of 120 patients. 60 of them were treated with carbopemetrexed, pembrolizumab, and 60 were treated with carboplatin and pemetrexed. The primary endpoint of that trial was objective response rate. And there was an improvement, 55% with the combination versus 35% with the chemo. So that's the place where I have been thinking about this combination more and more, when you need a significant response.
Now, so, for example, a patient who's sick and very ill, a lot of pulmonary
symptomatic,
symptoms.
Lots of cough, shortness of breath, be it cachexia, you need a response fast. Now, I will say that this ruling by the FDA is controversial, and many of my colleagues across the country are skeptical and have not begun using this combination in their practice. That said, we've used it at Sarah Cannon. And we have participated in many of the chemotherapy plus immunotherapy trials that will be reading out now in the next few months. So I think this is an option that's coming. It may not be carbo, pemetrexed, pembrolizumab may not be the only option in coming months. But I do think it is something that oncologists are going to use and going to want to know how to use in their tool arsenal for patients.
So another aspect to this is bevacizumab. And, you know, prior to all this happening with checkpoint inhibitors, we know that carboplatin and pemetrexed are the two most common chemotherapeutic agents. But some people, a significant number of people, would then add in bevacizumab on top of that. What about that issue of how to integrate bevacizumab into the treatment of these patients?
Well, I guess the easiest answer is, can we do all of it? There is a trial that enrolled patients to get chemotherapy, platinum doublet, plus bevacizumab, plus atezolizumab versus chemo with bevacizumab alone. And we hear that IMpower 155 trial is going to be the first to read out in the last half of 2017. And so that'll be interesting to know, because there has been some suggestion that bevacizumab modulates the immune characteristics of the tumor microenvironment. And so the addition of bevacizumab would test that. So we'll see.
So if you have a patient who gets that triplet and then they have disease progression, then what?
Well, so that's the big question that people are asking. There probably are not yet many patients in that group. Obviously, clinical trials are a great option for that patient population. Could you switch from a PD-1 inhibitor to a PD-L1 inhibitor? Could you switch to a PD-L1 inhibitor and add chemotherapy? Those are questions that need to be addressed in trials, things that probably options that patients will receive in the meantime.
What about anti-angiogenic therapy, not just bevacizumab, but there's another agent, ramucirumab, that can be considered in the second line? What about that as an option?
So certainly docetaxel plus ramucirumab had just become FDA approved, I believe, at the time that nivolumab was approved in the second line setting. So it sort of missed out on its heyday that I think probably it would have had if it weren't for the surge of immunotherapy. And so maybe this is an opportunity then to add the ramucirumab to the docetaxel and improve the benefit that patients are receiving. Theoretically, their performance status should be better because they've been treated with less toxic therapy in the frontline setting. So maybe there'll be more patients that are eligible for this combination.
We should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, several agents have been approved. Acalabrutinib was approved for patients with mantle cell lymphoma who've received at least one prior therapy. Abemaciclib was approved in combination with fulvestrant for patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative advanced or metastatic breast cancer with disease progression following endocrine therapy. And finally, the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib was approved for patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer with BRAF V600E mutations, and alectinib was approved as first-line therapy for patients with ALK-positive metastatic non-small cell lung cancer.